Chapter 5 Barracoon. By the time Cujo's group reached Ouida, they had been prisoners for several weeks. The Barracoon where they were locked up in the port city would be their home for the next 3 weeks. Forts built by the colonial powers served as prisons in Ouida. The French, Dutch, Danish, Portuguese, and English all built forts in Ouida specifically to enable the slave trade. Today, the last surviving Barracoon houses a museum in the central building with an area of 5 or 6 acres inside the huge encircling wall. The captives were held in pens built inside the confines of that wall. There may have been some areas for them to hide from the rain beneath a roof, but for the most part, it appears they were simply left exposed to the weather, like herds of cattle. By climbing up the walls of the jail, Cujo could see the Atlantic Ocean in the distance, as well as the Clotilda, riding the swells at anchor just beyond the breakers. The prisoners couldn't see the beach itself because a white house next to the Barracoon blocked their view. The ocean and a sailing ship would have been new sights for tribespeople who lived far inland. Likewise with the sight of the white men who milled around in front of the White House. Cujo said he had heard talk of white men growing up, but never laid eyes on one before. Food in the Barracoon consisted of rice mush cooked in palm oil. By Foster's account, there were more than 4,000 prisoners kept in groups in large pens. Cujo said that each pen housed people from different kingdoms. Sometimes the newly enslaved hollered back and forth to find out where other groups had come from. Cujo's pen was stuffed with people from his town, including cousins and friends. As he recounted the story to Hurston 67 years on, Cujo remembered that his 19-year-old self managed to play games with his fellow captives in the Barracoon. As he explained it, everyone in the prison was young. The slavers had killed anyone approaching 40 years old back in the village. Cujo, at 19, was probably around the average age of the captives. According to some historic accounts, during part of their imprisonment, the captives were tied by the wrist to large stakes embedded in the dirt floor of the Barracoon. But this didn't seem to concur with Cujo's report of climbing the wall of the prison to stare at the ships on the horizon or with playing games. It is possible the captives were bound in this fashion for their 4-day stay in the Barracoon at Abome, but not for the 3 weeks spent in Ouida. A month after their capture, Cujo tells Hurston, "We not so sad now." Yet another hardship was soon to come, as the survivors knew they were destined to be sold off and parted from their fellow townspeople. Yet another round of loss and separation. The moment arrived on May 23, 1860, when Foster strolled into the Barracoon in the company of a Dahomian prince and an interpreter. The Bonte captives were told to form circles, each containing 10 men or women. Foster stepped into the middle of each circle and inspected the captives, checking their teeth, their feet, their skin, exactly as one would inspect a horse or cow before purchase, searching for signs of disease or infirmity. After careful consideration, Foster selected a man from a circle, then a woman from another, moving on until he reached the 125 agreed to with the prince. After the selection process, Foster left the Barracoon and entered the adjacent White House. This is where the trade was finalized. The captives would be transported to the Clotilda the next morning, and Foster's gold would be delivered to the prince. For Foster, the transfer couldn't happen soon enough. The prince's delays had left him nervous, and he feared a double cross. The British often paid for information that led to the capture of a slaver, and a week's delay would certainly have allowed the Dahomians time enough to alert the British to the Clotilda's purpose anchored off Ouida. It is easy to imagine a scenario where the Dahomians collected Foster's gold in the morning, helped him load his captives, and then watched as the tipped-off anti-slaving squadron intercepted him before he'd even had a chance to weigh anchor and set sail. Back in the Barracoon, the guards told those selected they would be leaving in the morning. Extra food was provided for what Cujo described as a big feast. But it was a sad affair with many tears. We don't want to leave the rest of our people in the Barracoon. We all lonesome for our home. We don't know what going to become of us. We don't want to be put apart from one another. In the morning, they were chained together and led out of the prison, saying goodbye for the last time ever to friends, parents, and siblings. Cujo told Roche of an incident that didn't make it into Hurston's book, but that meant he almost avoided the trip to America aboard the Clotilda. He said that as the group waited for Foster to finish paying in the White House, a Dahomian stole him from the coffle and stashed him under the building. Perhaps the thief made a habit of peeling off a slave or two from large transactions, either to sell or keep for himself. Either way, Cujo was not liberated for long. According to his recollection, after hiding under the house for a time, while the rest of the group was led away, the sights and sounds of the nearby sea proved too much of a lure. The White House had obscured the view of the beach from the Barracoon during his 3 weeks of captivity. He snuck out from his hiding place to peer over a fence at the ocean. "I want to see what make of that noise, and how that water worker, how it fell on shore and went back again. I saw some of my people in a little boat, and I holler to them. Then Captain Foster spied me." In the version he gave to Hurston, Cujo never mentions being stolen or crawling from a hiding place. Instead, he says simply, "They almost leave me on the shore. But when I see my friend Kibi in the boat, I want to go with him. So I holler and they turn around and take me." It is a poignant moment, especially so if he volunteered himself to the slavers so he could stay close to his friends a little while longer, rather than seize the chance to escape. The Atlantic Ocean is clear and shallow along the wide beach at Ouida, with a low, almost non-existent dune line. A fringe of palms and papaya trees peters out about 300 yards from the water's edge, making for a long, sun-blasted walk through the sand. The ocean would have been the most dramatic thing Cujo saw on his walk toward captivity, and it is easy to understand his desire to see it with his own eyes. But the change in the surrounding landscape as the prisoners were marched from their rocky home near Bante to the red clay world of Abomey and finally the sandy streets of Ouida would have likewise been profound. On the beach, the slaves were slowly ferried out to the Clotilda at anchor a mile and a half offshore. Their bonds were removed as they boarded the giant canoes manned by Kru tribesmen. Cujo derisively refers to the crew as many costs. Because of their reputation of working for whites as porters and because of a long-standing West African joke that you could hire many crew for the cost of a single worker from another tribe. The crew threw the casks of rum and other trading goods overboard into the water for the crew to gather and ferry to shore. In a final humiliation before boarding the canoes, the Dahomian guards ripped what tattered clothes the prisoners were wearing from their bodies. Given that they had all been roused from sleep by the attack, it is likely none were fully clothed to begin with. And after a forced march that required sleeping in the dirt for several weeks, followed by nearly a month of captivity in the Barracoon, both clothes and bodies would have been filthy. When he was 79 years old, Cujo gave a newspaper interview and offered a brief insight into how he felt in the moment. He describes the events leading up to boarding the ship this way. "All of us that were left were taken to the coast and loaded into a big ship by white men, a sight we had never seen before. We were mighty scared, but we thought anything was better than death, such as our brothers and sisters suffered. So we made the best of it and came peacefully with those strange white men. I was between 18 and 20 years old when they caught me." As the captives were climbing up a rope ladder from the canoes to board the Clotilda, an alarming call came down from a man high up the mast in the rigging with a telescope. "Man aloft with glass," sang out, "sail ho, steamer, to leeward 10 miles," Foster wrote. The captain noticed a series of black and white flags, which he knew to be distress signals, spread for miles down the coastline. Foster's suspicions about a double-cross during his time on shore were suddenly manifest as two steamships emerged from behind a point about 6 miles south. On returning to his ship, Foster learned that a slave squadron vessel flying English colors had approached the Clotilda while he was ashore. The British had not searched Clotilda out of respect for the American flag, but being spied at anchor at one of the world's top three slave ports was not a good development. The captain climbed the rigging to study the ships with the telescope himself. If the steamers captured the ship as the prisoners were being loaded aboard, there would be no escape for him and his crew. Though only 75 of the agreed-upon 125 captives were on board, Foster hollered down to heave anchor and raise the sails. The only hope was for the Clotilda to outrun the steamships. But instead of heeding the captain's order, the crew mutinied again. The crew, thinking our capture inevitable, refused duty and wanted to take my boats from the vessel and go on shore, Foster recalled, explaining that trying to ride the ferocious surf in their tiny rowboats could only end in death. Even if they made it ashore, they'd be paddling right into the hands of the very people who had apparently double-crossed them and sold them out to the slave squadron ships. A fight ensued as the steamers grew larger on the horizon. In the account relayed by Mayer's son, as the crew attempted to lower the landing boats, the captain drew a pistol on them and forced them to raise sail. As the crew reluctantly made ready to depart, two more canoes pulled alongside with another 35 slaves, including Cujo, who was on board the last boat to make it to the Clotilda. He and the others were hurried aboard, put in leg irons, and forced into the hold as the ship began to make way with 110 captives. The 15 souls left behind on the beach would have been worth $22,500 back home, or more than $600,000 in today's dollars. As Clotilda's sails unfurled, the steamers changed course in an attempt to intercept her. But the Clotilda, flying all of her extra canvas, was running with the wind and making 11 knots within a few minutes, outpacing the slower steamships. 4 hours into the voyage, both Africa and the slave squadron disappeared below the horizon. So began the trip to America for the Clotilda captives, naked, terrified, and locked in the pitch black of the ship's hold in groups of 6 or 8. For people who had never seen the ocean to suddenly find themselves bobbing up and down in a small ship on the open Atlantic was disorienting and frightening. The creaking of the ship's planking, the whine of wind through the rigging, and the flapping and luffing of the sails were all foreign. Cujo remembers it this way. I so scared on the sea. The water, you understand me? It makes so much noise. It growl like the thousand beasts in the bush. The wind got so much voice on the water, oh Lord. Sometimes the ship way up in the sky, sometimes it way down in the bottom of the sea. During the history of the Atlantic slave trade, it is likely that hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people died of disease, seasickness, fear, or heartbreak before they made it across the ocean in what is famously known as the Middle Passage. Two people died in the close confines of the Clotilda's hold. They were dumped overboard by the captors. This was a common occurrence on slave ships. Some of the largest boats in the trade with Brazil, which carried more than 1,000 people at a time, could lose as many as 1/4 of those trapped on board each voyage, due to massive overcrowding, disease, and limited food and water. For those stolen from their homes, the Middle Passage was mostly about surviving. Again and again in the records of the slave squadron, we find vivid and awful accounts of life aboard captured slavers. The Negroes are packed below in as dense a mass as it is possible for human beings to be crowded. The space allotted them being, in general, about 4 feet high between decks. There, of course, can be but little ventilation given, wrote Lieutenant T. Augustus Craven, who commanded the steam-powered slave ship Hunter Mohawk, describing conditions aboard slavers he caught around Key West. These unfortunate creatures are obliged to attend to the calls of nature in this place, tubs being provided for the purpose. And here they pass their days, their nights, amidst the most horridly offensive odors of which the mind can conceive, and this under the scorching heat of the tropical sun, without room for sleep, with scarcely space to die in, with daily allowance of food and water barely sufficient to keep them alive. The passage varies from 40 to 60 days, and when it has much exceeded the shorter time, disease has appeared in its most appalling forms. The provisions and water are nearly exhausted, and their sufferings are incredible. 12 days after the Clotilda left Ouida, a man-of-war ship loomed on the horizon. Capture at this point with a ship full of Africans meant risking the gallows for captain and crew. When he was in his 80s, Cujo Lewis told a newspaper reporter an anecdote that appears nowhere else in the Clotilda record. He said that when a ship appeared on the horizon, Captain Foster made preparations for dumping all of his captives overboard. If it is true, it likely occurred at this moment. The reporter who interviewed Cujo captured the scene this way. The whole consignment of slaves was driven on deck and manacled to the anchor chain stretched along the decks. A fast cruiser of one of the powers policing the middle passage to put down the slave trade had given chase. Had the cruiser overhauled the slaver, the chain would have been let go, carrying its helpless, shrieking burden overboard. This inhuman act would have destroyed evidence against the slaver's crew. It was frequently done. Indeed, there are a number of accounts of slave cargoes dispatched to the bottom of the sea in just such a fashion, so the slavers might escape prosecution. Foster says the ship was saved from capture thanks to a heavy squall that arose suddenly, its high winds enabling Clotilda to outrun yet another pursuer. The next morning, the Clotilda caught the northeast trade winds, and her pace picked up to 14 knots per hour. Running a broad reach against a stiff wind, a nautical term for a favorable course that allows a ship to take full advantage of the breeze, Foster finally felt safe enough to bring his prisoners up on deck in groups so that they might walk around in the fresh air. On top of all the horrors, and coping with so many crushing losses, there was the boredom. So it was a welcome moment when the captives were allowed onto the deck for the first time. Cujo suffer so in that ship. On the 13th day, they fetchy us on the deck. We so weak, we ain't able to walk ourselves. So the crew take each one and walk round the deck till we get so we can walk ourselves. We looky and looky and looky and looky, and we don't see nothing but water. Where we come from, we don't know. Where we going, we don't know. Topside, the prisoners were given their daily water allowance of 1.5 pints. The water was sour, treated with vinegar to help ward off scurvy. Each group was allowed an hour topside, then made to wash the section of the ship where they were held. Manual bilge pumps in the hold would have moved the rancid wastewater overboard, making for a slightly more tolerable voyage through the middle passage than most captives experienced. Meals came twice a day. It seems likely that Foster, who would soon own 10 of the people on board, took extra care to see that they arrived in Alabama healthy and well-fed. The Clotilda also ended up carrying a lot of extra provisions. Mayer and Foster had hoped to buy as many as 170 people for their 27 pounds of gold, and packed accordingly when stocking the galley. The old sailing captains always made use of well-known water currents like the Gulf Stream, and dominant wind patterns, like the famous trade winds, to slingshot themselves toward their destination. By the evening of June 30th, less than a month out from Ouida, the Clotilda was already across the Atlantic, shooting through the gap in the reef around Abaco Island. These are treacherous waters, even today, and they almost claimed the Clotilda. Crossing the reef at twilight, the ship ran up on a sunken vessel, the wreckage just breaking the water's surface. The ship's lookout saw the wreck at the last moment before impact and sang out, "Hard a starboard!" signaling the helmsman to swing the wheel hard to the right. The Clotilda passed within 10 feet of the wreck, narrowly avoiding the same fate. Entering the Caribbean Sea, Foster removed the extra rigging that had been installed to make speed across the Atlantic. They were just days away from Alabama at this point, and the extra rope and wood made Clotilda conspicuous. The big square-rigged sails were stowed, and the extra timbers added to increase the height of the mast were taken down. The ship once again looked like a common schooner trading between Gulf Coast ports. The disguise was put to the test the very next morning when two men of war were spotted sailing nearby. Neither vessel altered course toward the Clotilda, which Foster steered northwest toward Mississippi. Once in the Gulf of Mexico, the captives were kept below decks to avoid discovery. "We've been on the water 70 days, and we spend some time laying down in the ship till we tired, but many days we on the deck. Nobody ain't sick and nobody ain't dead. Cap'n Bill Foster a good man. He don't abuse us and treat us mean on the ship," Cujo told Hurston. As they approached Mobile, the captain took a purposefully circuitous route, sailing right past Alabama and the twin forts that guarded the main entrance to Mobile Bay. He kept the ship far offshore as he passed, to ensure her sails wouldn't be spied by the lookouts at the forts or by the keeper of the Sand Island Lighthouse. Due to the curvature of the earth, ships disappear below the horizon once they are about 12 miles offshore. Foster was making for Petit Bois Pass, which runs between Dauphin Island and Petit Bois Island, barrier islands each about 7 miles off the coast. The pass is at the far west end of Dauphin Island, about 18 miles from Fort Gaines, which sits on the extreme eastern tip of the island, guarding the main entrance to the port of Mobile. He knew no one at the fort would be able to spy Clotilda as she came ashore there. This was all part of the plan hatched before the voyage even began. Foster and Mayer agreed they would try to sneak the Clotilda into the Mississippi Sound and hide her at a place called Point aux Pins. The point is a marshy outcropping that juts out from the Alabama coast between two geographic features, Bayou La Batterie and Grand Bay. As the English translation of its name suggests, Point of Pines features a dense forest of tall slash pine trees, which would have helped obscure the Clotilda from the view of any ships heading north up Mobile Bay. The area was uninhabited, except for a small outpost of fishermen who lived in rough cabins a little way up the bayou in an area known as Sans Souci, which translates as without a care. The plan called for Foster and the slaves to wait aboard the Clotilda for Mayer, who was supposed to be monitoring the rendezvous location for the ship's arrival. Mayer was to bring another vessel and take the captives up the bay into the Mobile River and onto his waiting plantation. Meanwhile, Foster would sail the Clotilda to Mexico, have her thoroughly scrubbed to wash away the evidence of slaving, then rename the ship, change its rigging, and purchase fake papers clearing her for a cargo run to New Orleans. Unfortunately, while Foster was sailing to Africa, Mayer and the other conspirators had bragged of their caper to anyone who would listen. Mayer became convinced he was being watched by federal officials lying in wait for Clotilda. Not only was Mayer too scared to post a watch at the rendezvous point as their plan called for, but the Clotilda made better time than expected on the return journey and was back in Alabama ahead of schedule. While Foster claims in his journal that he passed through Petit Bois Pass on July 9th, it is almost certain it was July 7th, a Saturday. Cujo remembered that the ship dropped anchor and stopped moving for the first time in the journey. The next morning, the crew brought a tree branch covered with green leaves to the captives to communicate that they were close to shore and had arrived at their destination. The slaves were told to stay quiet. Meanwhile, up on deck, Foster was having yet another showdown with a mutinous crew. After waiting all night and into Sunday morning for his partner in crime to arrive, per their plan, Foster realized he would have to go to Mobile and fetch Mayer to the ship. But the crew wasn't having it. They were now pirates in possession of a ship full of human contraband. It wouldn't matter to the authorities that none of them had known the true mission of the ship when they left port. The fact that they had sailed a ship full of kidnapped Africans across the ocean meant they were all eligible for the noose. The last thing the crew wanted was more time resting at anchor in American waters aboard the evidence of their crime. "The mates and crew did not want me to leave the vessel until they were paid for the voyage and said they would kill me if I attempted to take the Negroes ashore without their money," Foster wrote. The captain was allowed to leave the ship only after promising to return with the crew's wages. He rowed to shore and hiked to Bayou La Batterie about 2 miles distant. There he rented a horse and buggy from a farmer for $25 to ride to Mayor's house north of Mobile, about 20 miles away. On hearing that the cargo had landed, Tim Mayer sent one of his brothers to St. John's Church to pull his tugboat captain out of Sunday morning services. He ordered several of his steamboats to fire up their boilers to help collect the prisoners and hide the Clotilda. Instead of coal, Mayer burned huge slabs of bacon as fuel. Bacon burns hotter than coal, leading to a significant increase in speed. While Foster returned the farmer's wagon, James Mayer and an enslaved Cherokee named James Dennison steamed on pork power toward Point Aux Pins aboard the tugboat Billy Jones. Out of all the people the Mayers enslaved, Dennison was the most trusted. He had even been trained to pilot the family steamboats in the rivers. His Native American parents were enslaved in North Carolina. The Mayers bought him at the Mobile slave market after he'd been sold downriver and away from his family. Dennison and Mayer stopped in Bayou La Batterie to pick up Foster and traveled the last mile from the bayou to the other side of the point. But Foster was returning empty-handed. He had failed to get the crew's money from Mayer, who refused to honor the promise of double wages Foster had made the first time the crew mutinied on the way to Africa. The lack of money caused an immediate problem upon Foster's return. The crew thwarted every attempt to tie a tow rope from the Billy Jones to the Clotilda. They knew the people in the hold were worth $187,000 on shore, or about $6 million today. From the crew's perspective, the entire voyage had been a double cross from the moment they left the dock. They were unwittingly forced into piracy of the worst kind, had taken all the risk, and now the men responsible were refusing to pay them. Foster and James Mayer had no choice but to steam back up the bay to Mobile to get the cash, leaving their entire ploy vulnerable to discovery for the better part of a day. In Mobile, Timothy Mayer would only provide the originally promised wages, not the double pay. He sent his brother and Foster back with just $8,000 and told them he'd take care of the crew once they were on the big steamboat. Five toughs from the shipyard escorted Foster and the crew of the Billy Jones to make sure there was no trouble. They reached the ship at 9 p.m. The tug's throbbing and whistling steam engine was the first motor the Africans had ever heard. From down in the hold, they decided it sounded like a swarm of bees. The masts had been removed from the Clotilda as she lay behind the trees of the point. The idea was to disguise her as a barge for the trip up the bay. A tug pulling a barge up the bay at night was much less conspicuous than a tug pulling a seagoing ship. Plus, a ship returning to port from overseas was legally required to report to the harbor master on arrival. It was imperative that no one in the harbor know of her arrival. The lay of the land would provide some natural cover for this most perilous part of the journey. Both Fort Gaines and Fort Morgan face south toward the Gulf, watching for attack from foreign navies. The Billy Jones towed the Clotilda east through the Mississippi Sound, hugging the shoreline of the mainland, which was separated from the barrier islands and the forts by about 7 miles of open water. The moon was nearly full, casting a distressingly bright light on their activities, but it couldn't be helped. The tug made the run without lights, hoping the watchmen of the fort wouldn't spy them across so much open water. They passed through the bay without incident, a journey that would have taken about 3 hours with a ship in tow. The next challenge was getting past downtown Mobile and the port, which sits at the head of the bay on the Mobile River. The river was the main thoroughfare for everything shipped into or out of Alabama, and it cut through the heart of downtown. But it wasn't the only river that entered the top of the bay. In fact, the 13-mile-wide swamp that stretches east away from Mobile is now known as Five Rivers as a tribute to the other rivers that dump into Mobile Bay through the same swamp. Mayer and Foster planned to steam right past the entrance of the port and tuck into the nearby Spanish River, which was much smaller and totally uninhabited. This route took them around the backside of Pinto Island, which was then heavily forested, shielding them from any prying eyes in Mobile. A few miles farther north, well past the port, the Spanish and the Mobile rivers converged. From there, it would be a simple matter to transport the captives upriver to the plantations of the conspirators. What happened next is subject to contradictory explanations from those involved. Some of those contradictions appear to have been intentional, designed to throw investigators off the trail of Mayer and the other perpetrators. Their disinformation campaign worked well, thwarting the discovery of the ship for 160 years. For now, it is enough to know that the Billy Jones steamed into the Mobile River, met up with the Tsar, a family steamboat carrying both Timothy and Burns' mare, and headed 2 miles north into a swamp best described even today as a remote and haunted location. The shores are lined with a thick and marshy strand of bulrushes, wild rice, and cattails, chest high and difficult to walk through. Hanging overhead, cypress and tupelo trees drip with stalactites of Spanish moss. The big moon would have made for eerie silhouettes that night, coal black against its brightness. The rush of senses the Africans experienced as they climbed from the hold, the smothering embrace of the Alabama night, 90 degrees and dripping with humidity, the deafening roar of the swamp as hundreds of thousands of amorous insects, frogs, and birds sang out their desire to couple, and terror at being forced from the Clotilda onto the smoking and belching steamboat. Foster's widow relayed that the crew of the Clotilda mutinied one final time after the prisoners had been moved onto the steamboat. The sailors refused to board another boat carrying the human contraband. Foster forced them off the Clotilda with a pistol in each hand, declaring, "Hit the grit and never be seen in southern waters again," according to his wife. The mates and crew would have learned of the original plan to sail the Clotilda to Mexico for refitting and a new name, as they would have been expected to sail her there. But they were probably unaware that Mayer and Foster had changed the plan and were going to burn the ship, precisely because the crew had proven so troublesome. Afraid the crew would talk, Mayer was going to make them disappear. The reluctant crew finally joined Mayer and the captives on the Tsar. The ship's furnace was stuffed with the hot, burning slabs of bacon, and the race was on to catch up to Timothy Mayer's alibi, his ship, the Roger B. Taney, already partway to Montgomery on its usual Sunday run. The Taney's first mate left the dock with passengers and cargo at the regular departure time Sunday afternoon and set a leisurely pace. Dinner was not to be served until Mayer was on board. The passengers he ate with would become his alibi, proving he couldn't have been a part of a slave trading operation that night on the river. As the Tsar sped away, Foster and a couple of men carried 7 cords of fatwood, heart pine laden with explosively flammable sap, onto the Clotilda and spread them around the ship. Before lighting the conflagration, Foster rescued the desk from his cabin, along with his chair and the ship's clock. Just before lighting the fire, he would have opened the valves in the bilge, letting water pour into the hold. The ship would have been sinking even as he lit it on fire. In his journal, he described the end of the Clotilda's final voyage this way. "I transferred my slaves to a river steamboat and sent them up into the canebrake to hide them until further disposal. I then burned my schooner to the water's edge and sunk her." Fueled by the fatwood, the fire would have been intense. The glow over the swamp would have been noticeable even from Mobile, about 8 miles south. For Foster, it was a bittersweet moment. He would complain for the rest of his life that the ship was worth much more than the 10 people he was given for his role. That proved especially true when everyone was freed by the war just 5 years later. First, the prisoners had to be quartered somewhere away from the prying eyes of the law. Conspirator John Dabney's plantation at a big river bend on the Tombigbee was conveniently on the way, and it was agreed that it would likely prove safer than hiding them on property owned by one of the mayors, all located much closer to Mobile. The Tsar pulled up to Dabney's pier at the base of the plantation's giant cotton slide, and the captives were led onto dry land for the first time in 2 months. The decision was made to keep them down by the river, away from the plantation house and slave quarters, so as to avoid detection by anyone on the plantation, including the 47 American-born people Dabney had enslaved, who would definitely have noticed and talked a lot about the sudden presence of 110 Africans in their midst. Meanwhile, the Tsar motored back downstream to the Tom Bigby's confluence with the Alabama River, and then sped north up the Alabama for the rendezvous with the Roger B. Taney. Coming alongside the steamer, Mayer quickly moved the Clotilda's 11 crewmen into a locked room on the ship's upper deck, away from the main salon. They were provided with whiskey and a few decks of cards and told to keep quiet. The main goal was to keep them away from the rest of the passengers on the boat. At 9:30 p.m., dinner was announced in the salon and Mayer assumed his place at the head of the table. In a newspaper interview in 1890 with the St. Louis Globe Democrat, Mayer recounted how handily he comported himself. The reporter captured the scene this way. When the captain took his seat at the head of the table, his face wore a most nonchalant appearance and gave forth not the slightest intimation that he had been engaged in other than the legitimate performance of his duties. He was plied with all manner of questions as to his whereabouts during the earlier hours of the trip, but to all of these interrogatories, he made evasive replies and was wholly non-committal. Mayer's son later said that his father told the passengers that a sick cook was to blame for the late dinner. He couldn't have cared less about his customers' inconvenience. By making them wait for their supper until he could join them, Mayer gained dozens of witnesses who would swear he dined with them on the steamboat and couldn't possibly have been elsewhere smuggling people into the country. On arrival in Montgomery, the Clotilda crew were taken directly to the train station and placed on a mail train headed for New York. At this point, as they were being disappeared out of Alabama, they finally received their pay. But only the $700 they had originally been promised, not the double wages Foster guaranteed during their first mutiny in Puerto Playa when Clotilda's rudder was repaired. It is unknown whether the sailors complained or were just glad to have escaped from the clutches of the men who'd forced them into piracy. Captain Mayer steered the Roger B. Taney back to Mobile the next day and began bragging to his friends about his bet. Chapter 6. Into the Canebrake. The swamp around Mount Vernon would have been a wholly alien environment for the Africans. Tall and craggy cypress trees grow right out of the water along the banks, their limbs wearing a heavy drape of Spanish moss. Alligators are numerous, as are three species of venomous snake, bears, and at that time, panthers. The forests are thunderingly loud night and day in July, with the voracious hum of thousands of insect species, frogs, and hundreds of kinds of birds. Dabney's property was home to an almost impenetrable band of thick cane that lined the riverbanks and filled in most of the surrounding floodplain, which is where Mayer planned to hide the captives. Though they are almost unknown in Alabama today, dense canebrakes such as this used to crowd the banks of rivers throughout the state. It was one of the dominant ecosystem types along the rivers, but it has almost completely disappeared today. 30 major dams have so altered the hydrology of the state's rivers, including when the rivers overflow into the floodplains and for how long, that the water-loving canebrakes simply can't survive. It was into such a thicket that the captives were led as they emerged from the steamboat. Imagine a forest of dense bamboo, the stems growing so closely together they shade out any other type of tree. American naturalist William Bartram, who named many of the plants in the South during his travels in the late 1700s, was particularly taken with the majesty of the canebrakes along this same stretch of the Tom Bigby in 1775. He recounted that the reeds or canes grow here 30 or 40 feet high and as thick as a man's arm, or 3 or 4 inches in diameter. The captives were to remain in the swamp for their first 11 days in America, and were told not to speak above a whisper during their canebrake captivity, lest someone passing by on the river hear their foreign tongues. James Dennison, the enslaved riverboat pilot, was left to guard the captives with a few other people enslaved by Mare. To keep them secret, Dennison moved the captives every day, from one section of the swamp to another. None of the sources make mention of whether or how the captives were bound. It seems likely they were still chained in the small groups of eight as they had been on the ship, perhaps still by the neck. Of course, the strange new world of the swamp probably helped police the group as well, as it can be a scary place. By the height of the summer in July, several species of spider have reached enormous size, with bodies the size of your thumb and legs up to 4 inches long. Their webs are strung through the floodplain jungles in such number that it is almost impossible to avoid walking into them. The Africans would have recognized alligators, as Benin is home to a small crocodile species. But the West African crocs, which top out around 7 feet long, are much smaller than American gators. The largest alligator ever captured was killed in 2014 on the Alabama River, just a few miles from the swamp where the captives were stashed. That animal was 15 feet 9 inches long and weighed 1,000 pounds. The gator had a whole deer in its belly, an animal that weighed 115 pounds, swallowed in one gulp. Seeing a dangerous animal they were familiar with from home, but in far, far larger form, must have conjured fears in the captives about other threats lurking in the forests. And indeed there were. Water moccasins, biting yellow flies, and swarms of mosquitoes. All threats to which they would have been exposed fully naked. On the 11th day, some old clothes were provided. It had taken a while to round up enough for 110 people, and by the time the captives received them, they were a welcome comfort. Mare's houseboy, Noah Hart, described the clothes as rags and pieces of corn sack and skins tied round day bodies. Still, clothing was one of the only things Cujo mentioned when describing the first days in America to Hurston. Many of the survivors later spoke of the moment they were again able to put on clothes. The other thing he mentioned was the onslaught of the mosquitoes. In fact, he remembered it this way. "They keep us up the Alabama River and hide us in the swamp. But the mosquitoes, they so bad, they about to eat us up. So they took us to Cap'n Burns' mare's place and vied us up." Of course, it was not out of concern over mosquito bites that the captives were removed from the swamp. Rather, it was because Mare and his conspirators had gotten wind of a plot by federal officials to confiscate the Africans and prosecute the Mares and Dabney for illegal slaving. This seems an inevitable outcome, given the excitement in Mobile and indeed around the country concerning the arrival of the Africans. Recall that the news of the ship's departure for Africa had made national news shortly after she sailed. Just 2 days after her return, a news article appeared in a Georgia newspaper that, while it got the number of captives wrong, was accurate enough to include a telling detail. The schooner Clotilda, with 124 Africans on board, arrived in Mobile Bay today, and a steamboat immediately took the Negroes up the river. The newspaper I once worked for, the Mobile Register, hailed the Clotilda's arrival with a congratulatory editorial. "Whoever conducted the affair has our congratulations on his or their success." It went on to argue for the smuggling of more captives, repeating the trope that it was for the Africans' own good, after all. "We take it that the trade is, to all intents and purposes, opened. Why not? Why should not those who are in want of Negro labor import it at a low cost, when they are civilizing and Christianizing a set of barbarians by the same course?" Within a week, more articles appeared in national publications, containing the name of the ship and the detail of a steamboat's involvement. Likewise, the story spread from newspaper to newspaper via telegraph, from California to Texas to New York. Timothy Mare was arrested first and brought before his close friend, U.S. Circuit Court Judge William G. Jones. Coincidentally, the year prior, Jones had played an outsized role in how the federal courts handled the cases related to the Africans illegally smuggled aboard the Wanderer, the ship that inspired Mare to send the Clotilda to Africa in the first place. Judge Jones's precedent-setting courtroom decision regarding the trial of Mobilian Horatio Gould, who was charged with purchasing Africans imported aboard the Wanderer, drew nationwide attention. In his decision in the Gould case, the judge effectively gutted the laws that outlawed the international slave trade. Jones ruled that Gould could not be tried under the federal anti-slavery laws based on a specious technicality, arguing that once an illegally imported person had mingled with the inhabitants of the state, federal laws, including those that prohibited importation and sale of Africans in the first place, no longer applied to the captive. He ruled that only state courts had jurisdiction once an enslaved person arrived in the United States, and there were no state laws prohibiting the importation of captives from abroad. That Judge Jones should have recused himself from hearing Mayer's case is obvious from one fact alone. The pair were close enough friends that Mayer had named a steamboat after the judge. Instead of recusing himself, however, Jones released Mayer from custody immediately on the basis of the captain's sworn statement that he was aboard the Roger B. Taney on its regular run up the river, and that dozens of witnesses who dined with him on board the boat could corroborate that fact. But Mayer's release by Judge Jones had likely been a foregone conclusion, even before he was arrested, as Jones's sympathies aligned with Mayer's on the question of slavery. Within a year, at the outbreak of the Civil War, Jones would resign his federal post and sign on as one of the first district court judges in the Confederacy. While there is no proof, I suspect Mayer received a tip from his friend Jones, perhaps in the judge's chambers after Mayer's release, suggesting that the U.S. District Court's enforcement officers were planning to head straight for Dabney's in pursuit of the Clotilda captives. There is a story Mayer often repeated in interviews about what happened next. It is a self-glorifying tale, still told by Mayer's descendants, that has him once again outwitting all pursuers, especially the federal agents chasing him. In Mayer's telling, he had received word that the feds had chartered the Eclipse, a steamboat, to take them upriver to collect the captives at John Dabney's plantation. With the Eclipse already preparing to leave, there was no time to get word to Dabney's or to move the prisoners unless Mayer could find a way to stall the steamer. This came in the form of whiskey. Mayer dispatched an employee to buy several bottles and sneak them to the crew of the Eclipse, who were waiting at the dock for the federal agents and soldiers to show up. By the time the officers of the court appeared for the run upriver, supposedly the crew was so drunk they couldn't operate the ship. An entirely new crew had to be rounded up. Meanwhile, Mayer used the delay to stoke the engines of one of his boats once again with bacon sides and hurry upriver to Dabney's. The prisoners were quickly loaded up and moved to Brother Burns's plantation, miles away, located on another river altogether. By the time the federal marshal's team reached Dabney's, all they could find were several abandoned campsites where the Africans had been quartered during their first week and a half in the canebrake. At Burns's place, the captives slept under a roof for the first time, though it was just for a pole barn for wagons, a building with a roof but no walls. The same dreadful monotony ruled their lives there, up before dawn and disappeared into the swamp, where they were forced to remain until nightfall. When Roche interviewed the last eight survivors decades later, they remembered that James Dennison and Noah Hart would lead them with hand gestures and a shooing sound, such as you would drive chickens or geese. The captives remembered being overwhelmed with sadness and grief during this time. In the preceding 2 months, they had been roused from their beds at the point of spear and gun, watched as their siblings, parents, grandparents, friends, and leaders were killed, then locked in an internment camp for weeks. After weeks in the pen, their coming fate unknown, they were sold to the first white man they'd ever seen and loaded onto the first ship they'd ever seen, which was floating on the first ocean they'd ever seen. Then 45 days spent naked and chained in the dark hold of a ship. When they finally escaped the confines of the ship, it was only to find themselves still chained, but wandering naked through a dense jungle in an alien landscape. Their new reality was to be herded, like livestock, from place to place, by people they could neither understand nor communicate with. With the ruse of the eclipse successfully behind them, the word was put out to the conspirators to meet at a secret location to divvy up the loot. Dennison, the Cherokee pilot, loaded the men, women, and children of the Clotilda onto another steamboat and delivered them to the site, where the captives would soon undergo another heartbreaking separation. Males and females were divided and made to stand in two long rows. They had been captives for about 3 months at this point, first in the Barracoon, then 6 weeks on the ship, and now 2 weeks marched daily through a muddy swamp, still with no chance to bathe, with their new clothes nothing but rags to begin with. We know some of them, such as Sally Radoshi Smith, were just children, as young as 12. The buyers, who included the Mayer brothers, John Dabney, and a few other unidentified men, circulated among them, examining bodies, teeth, and feet. Before any were sold, the Mayers and Captain Foster took turns making their selections. The best accounting from the various sources suggests that Timothy Mayer took 32, evenly divided between men and women, while Burns Mayer took 20, Foster got 16, and James Mayer got 8, including Cujo. The final 34 were sold to slave dealers from Montgomery to help cover the costs of the voyage. They would have been worth more than $500,000 in today's currency. It is not known what happened to most of the final 34, but a number of them, including Sally Radoshi Smith, ended up at points north, mostly in a place called Bogue Chito, near Selma. As they were parted, Cujo said, "We were very sorry to be parted from one another. We cry for home. We can't help but cry, so we sing." As the group sold to the slave dealers were marched off to their new lives, the slave dealer herding them suddenly ushered his coffle of Africans off the road and hid them in the bushes. A string of wagons from a traveling circus was coming, and the dealer didn't want his foreign charges discovered. The captives said they were forced to face away from the road, perhaps to hide their facial scarifications and tattoos. As the circus passed, an elephant trumpeted, an unmistakable sound to anyone who has ever heard it. This was especially true for a group of people just removed from a country where elephants were so common that a depiction of an elephant in a crown graced the royal flag of King Glele, the man responsible for selling them to the Americans. As the survivors recounted the story to Roche decades later, the captives began hollering, "Ele, ele," meaning home, and then Agenaku, the Fon word for elephant. Alas, the elephant was as much a stranger and a captive as the Africans. It may well have been offering a lament for its homeland, just as the Clotilda captives continued to do. "Our grief so heavy looked like we can't stand it. I think maybe I die in my sleep when I dream about my mama," Cujo told Roche. Shortly after the Clotilda passengers were divided up, a series of letters from the U.S. Attorney of the Southern District of Alabama were sent to Washington, D.C. Federal summonses followed quickly on July 27, 1860, issued for Burns Mayer, John Dabney, and Captain William Foster. This was 18 days after the ship arrived, and about a week after the prisoners had been divided and sold. The federal documents are all handwritten in longhand. The court records for the case are a testament to the rapid acceleration of government bureaucracy in the 1800s, with pages and pages of legal text copied over and over when really all that was needed was a single paragraph that could have covered all of the accused. For Burns Mayer, the tight cursive script of the summons states, "Against Burns Mayer, that 103 Negroes were imported or brought to the United States from a foreign kingdom, place, or country, with intent to hold, sell, or dispose of said Negroes or slaves, or to hold them to service or labor, and that the said Burns Mayer holds the Negroes aforesaid." The papers state that Burns had 25 men, 25 women, 25 boys, and 25 girls, making for a total of 100. Dabney's summons is identical in its details, except for suggesting he had 40 of the captives. Together, the men are charged with holding 140 Africans out of a supposed total of just 103. While the numbers don't add up or reflect how many prisoners Burns and Dabney actually got, The summonses show that the federal officers knew, even at this early date, that the group had been split up among the conspirators, and they show the feds knew who the perpetrators were. Interestingly, the summons for Dabney and the mayors were issued on July 27, 1860, but not served for 5 months until December 17, 1860. There is no explanation in the records for the delay in serving the men. This delay seems suspicious because the whereabouts of all the Clotilda players were well known, save the crew of sailors that had been disappeared on the train heading north. It would have been a simple matter to serve the summonses to the mayors, Dabney, and Foster promptly, rather than months later. But the orders to serve them had to come through Judge Jones's court. It seems a safe bet that the mayor family's long friendship with Judge Jones was responsible for the laconic pace. In any case, the result of the summonses was unambiguous. In the final record for the cases against the men, court officer C.M. Godbold stated, "The within-mentioned Negroes not found in my district, 20th December, 1860. With no Africans, the cases against the mayors and Dabney were dismissed." Foster's case, on the other hand, was a little more complicated. It was clear and irrefutable that he had returned with cargo from a foreign port without registering with port officials in the United States or paying proper duty and taxes for the cargo. Not only did he not check in as required, but he was suddenly unable to account for the whereabouts of his large and very valuable ship. For Foster, the charge meant a $1,000 fine, equal to $32,000 today, but he never had to pay it. After several continuances and delays, his day in court was going to be Friday, April 12, 1861, but that date just happened to coincide with the opening battle of the Civil War. Federal courts across the South were disbanded as the judges, Jones included, resigned and were appointed as district judges for the Confederacy. Foster's case is mentioned twice in federal court records from 1866, the year after the war ended. It appears there may have been some interest in prosecuting him then, but the trail goes cold. There are no records indicating he ever paid the fine. In the end, not only was no one hung for the Clotilda's illegal slaving run, as Mayer had predicted a year prior on his steamboat, no one was ever convicted of a single crime. In fact, the only person ever hung for slaving, Nathaniel Gordon, captain of the Erie, was captured just 3 weeks after the Clotilda arrived safely back in Alabama in July of 1860. Gordon was caught in the Caribbean with 897 slaves locked in the hold. He was executed in 1862, after Abraham Lincoln became the first president to refuse to pardon a convicted slaver. At Gordon's trial, Judge W.D. Shipman handed down a death sentence, quoting the Bible and warning Gordon of the eternal fate that awaited him for his great crime. "Do not attempt to hide its enormity from yourself. Think of the cruelty and wickedness of seizing nearly 1,000 fellow beings who never did you harm and thrusting them beneath the decks of a small ship, beneath a burning tropical sun, to die of disease and suffocation, or be transported to distant lands and be consigned, they and their posterity, to a fate far more cruel than death." It is a safe bet that Mayer and Foster both followed Gordon's trial with more than a little relief at their narrow escape from a similar end.